Hello, this is Andrew Walter. This is number 0320, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0320. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Patty Farmer, author of Playboy Swings, How Hugh Hefner and Playboy Changed the Face of Music. How big was Playboy's influence in music?
I think many people are not aware, and that was one of the most interesting things in writing this book. And actually, that's why I wrote this book. There have been books about the Playboy bunnies, books about the magazine, about the original Playboy himself, Hugh Hefner. But there's never been a book about Playboy entertainment. And in doing all my research, I found out that for almost 20 years, Playboy was the largest employer of entertainment in the country.
Science writer Andrew Vizakis, the night sky. My guy talks about the discovery of water on Mars.
This is something that NASA has been really trying to pin down for decades, really, is trying to see if Mars is really all that barren, desert-like world. And it turns out they've had this mantra of follow the water. That's simply because the ultimate goal for NASA is to see if there is life on the red planet. You know, as we understand life here on our planet Earth, is that water is a key ingredient for life.
October 16th is National Bosses Day. Dr. Kevin Mays talks about bad bosses.
There is no training for a boss. The reason somebody becomes a boss is they're really good at doing a particular job. So if I'm an accountant and I'm really good at accounting, how do I get acknowledged? I get a promotion. And as I get promoted, it's suddenly a totally different skill set that's required of me. And perhaps something I've never learned about, I've never had any training in, it's about relationship with that one. So because I'm good at mastering this task, I get promoted to a role that requires me to have good relationships with people, something I might not understand at all. Just because somebody's good at a task doesn't make them good at managing people.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0320 was Andrew Walter, the propagandist, that's his words, not mine, the propagandist at Edelman Digital based in San Francisco. And many, many years ago, many, 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 many years ago, Andrew Walter was one of my producers on the old radio show that I did many, many years ago. Thank you very much, Andrew, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 61-year-old Paul Neverson drew a knife on a bank teller in Raynham, Kent, England, and demanded £500, and suggested that the teller simply deposit the money into his account. The teller hit his panic button. Neverson turned to walk out, but another customer intervened and disarmed him of the knife, and police quickly caught him. It was his second unsuccessful bank robbery of the day. Even his attorney admitted Neverson was an idiot. There was no disguise. It was ridiculous. It only had one ending, Danny Moore told the judge, and here it is. The robbery had little chance of succeeding. Tellers are behind reinforced bulletproof glass, Moore said. Unless they take leave of their senses in offering the money, it was not going to work. Moore said Neverson had secured a job on the Greek island of Corfu and needed the money to get there. He says he very much hopes to take up that job opportunity on his release. Neverson was jailed for 2 years. So whether that job is waiting for him when he gets back, I don't know. But, you know, I don't know what's crazier, attempting this idiotic crime or accepting a job in Greece with their current economy. And I know what you're thinking. You're probably thinking to yourself, why use this story now right at the top of the show and instead of saving it for the idiot of the day later on? And, you know, it crossed my mind. But believe me, I do have an idiot of the day coming up later on in the program, so stick around for that. But I figured, you know, his lawyer already called him an idiot, so I wasn't going to compound the situation. Moving right along, 46-year-old Melissa Drake was driving in Fort Myers, Florida, with three children in her car when she noticed a Mercedes was weaving in and out of traffic coming up behind her. She remembers telling herself, this is not going to end well. The driver passed her and cut her off. She honked. In response, he brake-checked us to the point where I had to slam on my brakes, Drake said. Then the Mercedes slowed down until he was beside her. My son and I looked at each other right at the same time and said, is that a gun? The driver pointed it right at her son, she says. To mess with me is one thing. To mess with my children, you don't mess with Mama Bear, Drake said. She called 911, but before police could find the driver, someone else called 911 to report the same driver was standing outside his vehicle jumping up and down on one leg. He's spewing blood from his leg, said Gail Sarkino. He just drops right there in the center lane. The unnamed driver had crashed into a guardrail, but it's unclear if it happened before or after he had accidentally shot himself in the leg. You see, this is the kind of story that has all the stuff file basics. An idiotic road rage situation. A story from Florida where everything seems to happen, as you know. And a guy who meets karma head on. The only thing missing from this story is Walmart. Oh, but wait. I do have a Walmart story to follow it up with. Police in South Union Township, Pennsylvania says 46-year-old David Lee is the one who swiped a Straight Talk cell phone from a Walmart shelf on September 15th, but wound up in the hospital. After snatching the phone, Lee went to a different section of the store and tried to open the packaging with a knife, but mishandled it and slashed his arm so severely that he had to be medevaced to UPMC Presbyterian Hospital in Pittsburgh, and a hazmat crew had to be summoned to clean up all the blood that Lee had spattered. Yeah, we have a gusher and cleanup in aisle four. You know, apparently the cell phone packaging was childproof and idiot-proof. Again, someone else I could have made the idiot of the day, but that's later in the program. Wait for it. Police in California say they have arrested the MaxiPad bandit, accused of burglarizing an auto parts store with a feminine hygiene pad on his face. Apple Valley police said the man's face was partially obscured by the pad when he broke into the Battery Mart after it closed Monday, but surveillance footage was clear enough for officers to identify him as 51-year-old Gary Victor. Victor, whom police said they have dealt with in the past, was arrested on Tuesday. Police said they believe he may have been under the influence of intoxicating substances at the time of the break-in. Mark Weddle, the owner of the Battery Mart store, said the surveillance footage included a clear shot of the suspect's face without the sanitary napkin. Right away, everybody started saying we should call this guy the MaxiPad Bandit, Weddle said. We had a pretty good picture of his face because he came to the store the first time and looked in the window without his maxi pad on, Weddle said. But when he came back and he had the maxi pad over his eyes, I guess he thought it was going to take care of everything. Police confirmed the object on Victor's face was a feminine pad. It wasn't surprising, but yes, that is in fact what he was trying to conceal his identity with, and he didn't do a very good job, police spokeswoman Trish Hill said. You know, some people, when they go to jail, have to worry about violent beatings from other inmates. I have a feeling this guy is going to have to deal with unmerciful ribbing from the prison population. First question I'm sure another inmate will ask is, was it new or used? Ooh. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Scotland's Highlands were called in September when a Buddhist retreat participant, Raymond Story, became riled up that another, Robert Jenner, had boiled water for his tea, but not Story's. After Story vengefully snatched Jenner's own hot water, Jenner punched him twice in the head, leading Story to threaten to kill Jenner, but also asking plaintively, "Is this how you practice Dharma?" Yes. There's nothing more ironic than a Buddhist beating, is there? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Patty Farmer is the author of a rather comprehensive book that delves into the Playboy Empire and its influence on the world of music. The book is called Playboy Swings, How Hugh Hefner and Playboy Changed the Face of Music. She's on the line with us right now from Orange County in Southern California. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me, and thank you for your interest.
Thanks for being on the program. Now, I'm just wondering, how many people, would you say the majority of people, are not aware of the influence that the Playboy Empire has had on music?
I think many people are not aware, and that was one of the most interesting things in writing this book. And actually, that's why I wrote this book. As you probably know, there have been books about the Playboy Bunnies, books about the magazine, about the original Playboy himself, Hugh Hefner, but there's never been a book about entertainment, Playboy entertainment. And in doing all my research, I found out that for almost 20 years, Playboy was the largest employer of entertainment in the country, in the United States. So I find that rather remarkable that nobody has focused on this huge contribution that's been made to the entertainment world.
It's interesting you should say that, because just by coincidence, a couple of weeks ago, I was looking at some YouTube video. I was checking up on people like Sammy Davis Jr., for instance, and there were clips from various Playboy parties, which was, I guess, a show that was done. And there was always music. There was always live music. There was always performances taking place. Is that part of what was going on in the culture within the Playboy world?
That was part of it. Hefner had become such a phenomenon that by the late 50s, he was asked to do a variety show or a TV show. And I'm sure the networks had in mind a variety show similar to Ed Sullivan or other shows of the day where guests would come out and sing a song or tell a joke and then maybe sit and chat for a little bit. But Hef had a different idea. He wanted to make it a little bit more intimate setting. So he had it in his home, supposedly, where everybody's sitting around and sitting on couches and talking. And what do you know, Sammy Davis might pop in and maybe they could talk him into singing a song. And the same with Tony Bennett or Cy Coleman or, one of the big comedians of the day. So it was a different kind of format there.
Is Playboy's involvement within music merely an outgrowth of Hef's own personal interest and style of in music?
Yeah, Peter, you've hit that right on the head. Hef loved jazz. He always loved jazz, going back to high school even, where he wrote about it for the school paper. So it was a personal passion of his, and he used it, he showcased it and used it for celebrations. You know, the first Playboy Jazz Festival was a big party that he threw to commemorate the 5th anniversary of the magazine. And because he loved jazz, he had his second in charge pick up the phone and invite Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong to come and perform. And it ended up that it went on for 3 days and became an iconic festival. But that's the long answer to your quick question. I'm sorry.
No, it's no problem. Going back to the beginning, I mean, you know, Playboy is this iconic brand name and this magazine. But going back to the beginning of, for instance, when he got involved in music and got involved with jazz festivals, to be honest, you know, the United States and Canada was a little more puritanical at that time when Playboy first started. Were any of the artists who first jumped on board with things like the Playboy Jazz Festival, were any of them leery to attach themselves to the Playboy brand name?
Not so much the artists, but the city officials. Hef wanted to have it in his hometown of Chicago. And the first venue, it was run by the city and Chicago Stadium. They said, yes, you know, of course you could rent the stadium. And then they had a lot of pressure from both the church and civic leaders. Well, actually, the church put the pressure on the civic leaders, and they withdrew their permission. So at the last minute, they had to scramble around and find another venue to hold a festival. So, and that's a theme that's repeated many times. You know, I'm sure you're aware that between the church and the conservative groups and the government, there was always somebody trying to put Playboy, either the Playboy magazine or just the whole Playboy organization, out of business.
What about today? What about the role that Playboy plays within music today? Is it as strong as ever, or has it declined, or has it increased?
Well, I think it's, they set the groundwork back in, you know, the late 1950s for the festival was the big thing, and it's still going strong today. It's become a yearly event that jazz performers, you know, really mark on their calendars. June, you know, make sure we have a date for the jazz festival, and everybody jockeys for a position. So it's certainly an iconic and a prestigious event. Many people told me that, you know, Sonny Rollins, the famous Sonny Rollins, really looked forward to playing the festival. Al Jarreau, you know, all the greats from the day, all the way up to the younger troupe today. And the Playboy clubs, the original batch, the last one closed in 1988, but we have 21st century Playboy clubs opening up. So I think that they're always involved. As long as we have Hugh Hefner around, which we still do, and he's vital and active in things, and he's always pushing the music.
In putting this book together, did you have personal interaction with Hugh Hefner to get this book off the ground?
I did. Not actually to get it off the ground. I had to get about, you know, a good, you know, quarter of the way into it before I actually got that phone call from Steve Martinez, who said, you know, Miss Farmer, I wanted to introduce myself. I am Hugh Hefner's personal archivist, and he asked me to call you and open our archives to you. So I think I had to win their trust. They knew my journalistic history. They knew I was serious, but I think they wanted to know that I was really worth their time. And I was later told that on a daily basis, they get hundreds of requests from journalists around the world who are writing articles or writing books, or say they are, you know, that want to talk to Hef and talk to the other people at Playboy. So it took me about a year into this before I had full access. And now I am, you know, I don't want to toot my own horn, but Playboy says I'm one of theirs, you know, so I do feel like I've been embraced and I have the Playboy stamp of approval.
Excellent. Well, in talking to Hef, how reflective was he about the whole process of music within the Playboy organization?
Hef is, you know, very willing to talk and to chat about it. Going back to, you know, 1953 and how the magazine got started, there are also other people that luckily we still have around today. Victor Lowndes, who was the second in charge, was very forthcoming. Keith Hefner, Hef's brother, who was there at the clubs. You know, he was a big part of the Playboy clubs. You know, he was very informative. So everybody loves talking about it. You know, it was a great time. The music was wonderful. The clubs were definitely iconic and important. They gave a lot of artists their start, and they gave them a stage to be able to perfect their craft. You know, we have people like Joan Rivers that performed there. Al Jarreau ran on. And in the books, Playboy Swings, they all talk on the record and tell their stories about performing either at the festival or at the clubs, and how important it was in the development of who they became and the development of music. And also the advancement of civil rights. You know, here in the States, the clubs opened in 1960, and we were still operating under segregation. And Hefner was truly colorblind, and is credited with breaking the color barriers on stage and in the audience, which I found that fascinating.
Well, we have less than a minute, and I just want to bring up the fact that you talked a little bit about your own pedigree, and you've written one of your previous books, The Persian Room Presents, which talks about the halcyon days of New York nightlife. And when you put the two books together, people often talk, especially when you get to a certain age, of the good old days. Were they really the good old days, or are these also some good old days as well, or is this an era gone by?
You know, you're exactly right, Peter. I think it was just a different time. You know, it was a time of the small nightclubs and small jazz clubs. And unfortunately, you know, maybe some of the larger cities, you know, New York, we still have the Blue Note and the Cafe Carlyle and some other small clubs, but not as many as we had 2 years ago and not as many as we had 5 years ago. So unfortunately, the smaller clubs are closing. I think they're not economically vibrant for owners to run them. You know, we have Birdland, which is wonderful and thriving and a good showcase. But I think, you know, the festivals, the larger venues are what's replacing what we had in the good old days. Mm.
The book is called Playboy Swings, How Hugh Hefner and Playboy Changed the Face of Music. It's written by Patty Farmer. Patty, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
Patty Farmer, author of Playboy Swings, How Hugh Hefner and Playboy Changed the Face of Music. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0320, and you'll find links to Patty's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about water on Mars. Plus, we'll discuss bad bosses. And, of course, there is an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But I got a lot more Stuff File news right here, right now. The TSA said a 20-minute evacuation at a Denver airport was caused by wedding favors labeled TNT and designed to look like explosives. The Transportation Security Administration said in an Instagram post, an agent monitoring the X-ray machines for checked luggage at Denver International Airport on September 22nd noticed a bag contained small glass bottles bearing wax tops and fuses. The bag was opened and the bottles were found to be labeled TNT. The airport was evacuated for 20 minutes while bomb specialists examined the items, which turned out to be novelty wedding favors containing bath salts. The TSA said agents discovered the bride and groom's names both started with T, leading to the TNT label. You get it? Yeah. Be mindful of what you're traveling with and what it might appear as on an X-ray monitor, the TSA said in its Instagram post. Now, to me, one of the big issues in this story is that the TSA is on Instagram. But besides that, it looks like this is the beginning of a marriage that's going to be explosive. Yes. Well, we have a couple of stories from the animal world. The first one comes from Warman, Saskatchewan. Police there said an unruly goat. And by the way, is there any other kind of goat but unruly? Anyway, an unruly goat that insisted on sleeping in the entrance of a Tim Hortons was arrested while officers sought to find its owners. The RCMP said two Warman officers were called to the Tim Hortons early Sunday by employees who said they repeatedly led the goat out of the eatery, but the animal, who just came back in through the automatic doors, was trying to take a nap in the entrance. Now, the RCMP members believe he was just cold and decided to lie down and wanted to sleep in the entrance. He was arrested, and I'm doing air quotes here, and escorted into a police vehicle. He was very unhappy with this, so the members decided to take him home instead of holding him in a holding cell at the detachment. That's what, according to the RCMP. Now, the RCMP members went door to door, but were unable to identify the goat's owners, and animal control officers told them the agency didn't typically deal with goats. The wayward goat was taken to a local animal hospital, where it was later reunited with its owners. You know, it's not very often where we have a story with someone using the term, "We've got your goat," in the literal sense. Yeah. And our second animal story comes from Maine, where police said a dog, a small dog, was to blame for driving its owner's pickup truck into a lake by knocking the vehicle out of gear. The Ellsworth Police Department said the Yorkie's owner had been walking the dog around Branch Lake Saturday afternoon, and he put the canine back into his pickup truck while it was idling. Lieutenant Harold Page, told the Ellsworth American that the dog knocked the truck out of gear and it rolled down the parking lot into the lake. The Ellsworth Police Department said in a Facebook post the dog was rescued from the submerged pickup by a woman who was a friend of the owner. The truck was fully submerged, and without the quick response of the family friend, the man would have lost his companion. "She is a hero in my book," the post said. Police say the pickup was fished out of the lake by a towing crew, but the vehicle was considered a total loss. You know, we've often seen stories where dogs either put a car in gear or, in some cases, even shoot people with a gun. I believe these are dogs that are under the influence, the hypnotic influence, of a cat. Yes, you heard me. As I've often said on this program, cats are evil. Little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. You folks aren't listening to me closely enough, and when you realize that's true, of course, it will be too late. But I warned you. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have a couple of items we like to call relentless wannabes. Number one, authorities in Winter Haven, Florida, arrested 28-year-old James Garfield with the typical faux police setup, a Ford Crown Victoria with police lights, uniform with gold star badge, video camera, taser, and business cards printed with law enforcement, explained Garfield lamely the law enforcement was just a printing mistake. Okay. And number two, in nearby Frostproof, Florida. And do you think they ever have frost in Frostproof, Florida? Anyway, 48-year-old Thomas Hook was also arrested in September, his 14th law enforcement impersonator arrest since 1992. His paraphernalia included the typical Crown Vic with the prisoner cage in back, scanner, spotlight, private investigator, and fugitive recovery badges, and an equally bogus card identifying him as a retired Marine Corps major. Hook's one other connection to law enforcement? He's a registered sex offender. Yeah. That's more wackiness from Florida, folks. More wackiness from Florida. It's like that place is another planet. Which, by the way, is a segue to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The folks at NASA are giddy like schoolgirls these days with word that they may have found water on the red planet. They speculate briny water has been found in streaks that flow down slopes in the summer on Mars. To talk about news that NASA itself is calling a 9 on a scale of 10, we're joined once again by science writer Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, and a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. He joins us via Skype from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter.
So, water on Mars. This is exciting.
It definitely is. You know, this is something that NASA has been really trying to pin down for decades, really, is trying to see if Mars is really all that barren, desert-like world. And it turns out, you know, that, you know, they've had this mantra of follow the water, basically. And that's simply because, you know, the ultimate goal for NASA is to see if there is life on the red planet, if there's any sign of life. And, you know, as we understand life here on our planet Earth, which is the only example in the universe that we know of does have life so far, is that water is a key ingredient for life. You know, and of course I have to say that with a caveat that it's life as we understand it, how it's made here on Earth. There could be other ways of making life, but the only way we can follow scientifically is what we find here on Earth. And water is a key. So NASA is really trying to follow the water everywhere in the universe that they're looking at. And Mars being literally at our astronomical doorstep is turning out now with this new announcement that it probably has free-flowing water, at least temporarily, on Mars today. And this is very different from what we've been hearing for many years with other missions before, that yes, maybe Mars was once, you know, filled with water, but that was in the distant past, billions of years ago.
Now, that's
changing.
Now, we only got the announcement just recently about the fact that there's water on Mars. How long do you think they've been holding this information? In other words, I'm assuming that they've checked and double-checked to make sure that they're absolutely correct in hypothesizing what they have. How long of a process do you think that is, or do you have any idea?
Well, they actually, you know, looking at the lines of evidence that they had, this really dates back to the year 2010. That's when they first spotted these long, dark, and fleeting streaks on the surface of Mars, and I think up to 4 different regions. So they've had this data for about 5 years, and the problem was that they, you know, one season wasn't enough to look at these streaks. They needed to go back multiple times to see how they form, how they grow, and then how they disappear. And they noticed that this was definitely seasonal. They would these long streaks, these dribbles, you could call it, down the sides of craters, were forming in the early spring as Mars was warming up locally, and then really got going during the summertime when the temperatures were the warmest, and then they disappeared in the fall and winter. And they wanted to see this over multiple years to confirm exactly what's going on. And the cameras on board one particular spacecraft called NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, they have very high resolution cameras, and they would be able to basically repeatedly point these cameras at Martian slopes and craters. And they could see that the dark streaks appeared to lengthen and vanish during the warmer seasons, and they appeared each time in the same places, some near the planet's equator. And and basically they look like they oozed from the steep slopes and crater walls. So
okay,
it
so
was very exciting for them.
One of the things they were very quick to say was that they were saying it was salt water as opposed to fresh water. How do they know?
Right. So what they've noticed, they've identified that these streaks had hydrated salts in 4 separate areas on Mars. And they call these salts perchlorates. And they have water molecules basically trapped in their crystal structures. And so, you know, what this means is basically they are able to spot, by the way, these hydrated salts, the chemical fingerprint using the instruments aboard these orbiters, particularly the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And so what the presence of these hydrated salts in these flows that they're seeing means that the streaks are forming due to contemporary water. And that's what the researchers have been saying. So, you know, the big question is, where is this water coming from? Is it coming from, from an aquifer or melting maybe ice that's just underneath the ground and underground? Or is it coming, is it atmospheric? You know, is something coming directly from the atmosphere? This is something that might be happening as well, that these salts are absorbing the water vapor in the Martian atmosphere. And, you know, if the humidity in the Martian atmosphere gets high enough, then these kind of salts basically absorb the atmospheric water until the salt dissolves and forms a liquid solution. All of this is maybe done over a course of just a few months, perhaps. You know, these are just theories at this point.
Well, speaking of theories, I was about to ask, does this revelation now change in any way, shape, or form what people thought, or what the scientists thought, right, I should say, about Mars, or does it just confirm what they suspected before?
I think it's confirming a lot of what they were suspecting. Because, you know, for decades, we've been sending spacecrafts to Mars and orbiters showing us, you know, it dates back to the early 1960s when we saw our first pictures of the surface of Mars, you know, that we saw all this landscape, that dramatic landscapes that were sculpted by some kind of liquid. You know, we think it was billions of years ago when the planet was warmer and watery when all this happened, but there were channels and canyons carved by, you know, flowing water on Mars. And we think now, you know, before it was just a liquid of some sort, we suspected it was water, but now it kind of confirms that water is still there even on Mars. It may be hidden and maybe in very trace amounts, but it still exists. It's not a completely desert planet. That's what this is telling us.
So now that they've confirmed this, what's the next step?
Well, the next step, this is what's so interesting now, is in terms of exploration, is now we're identifying specific locations on Mars where we think there is currently water for locations to send future robotic missions, for sure, to find evidence of life, potentially. As I said at the beginning, at the start, was that water is the key ingredient for life. So if we want to find life on Mars, then it's a kind of a great idea if we kind of follow that water and land in that area and try to look for life. It might be underground, it might be under a rock, perhaps, microbes of some sort. But these are the locations. We can now pinpoint them on the map of Mars. And also, this could be a boon for future human exploration of the red planet, as well as having some sort of water resource or a reservoir available for future astronauts.
There was or has always been chatter or talk that Mars might have been like Earth many, many, many millennium ago. If that is indeed the case, could the water that's there now be just basically the last vestiges of water from an era gone by?
Exactly. Exactly, Peter. That could be there. You know, and we think that an ancient sea once covered about a fifth of Mars' surface. And, you know, and where has all this water gone? You know, some of it, most of it may have evaporated into the atmosphere, but some of it may have basically seeped into the ground and is now in large aquifers and reservoirs underneath the surface. So I think the future missions are going to be looking very much, there'll be drilling that's going to be involved and seeing where this water is following that water. Because now we see traces on the surface, liquid water traces that are very temporary. But this is something now that we can clue into and zero in our missions in the future, where this water may still reside.
Well, it certainly is something to look for. And maybe while they're up there, they can also find Matt Damon.
Exactly.
Andrew, it's always a pleasure talking to you. How can people find you?
Well, folks can actually see my weekly night sky coverage at National Geographic News. I write the Starstruck column that appears every Monday. And of course, they can also follow me on my Facebook page, The Night Sky Guy on Facebook, and my webpage, thenightskyguy.com.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and of course you'll find the link right here on my website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0320, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It's been called the most popular song in the world, but for years, many people have been afraid to sing it in public out of fear they'd be sued. Can you guess the song? It's the song that goes, Happy Birthday to You. And since 1988, when a music publishing company bought the copyright to the song, movie production companies, restaurants, and others wanting to sing the song in public have had to pay a large licensing fee or risk getting sued. However, a federal judge has now ruled that the music company that's been charging those fees doesn't hold a valid copyright to the song. Let's be fair, that doesn't mean someone else doesn't have the rights to the song, though. It was written by a couple of sisters in the late 1800s and was eventually published in some songbooks. The publisher of one of those books got a copyright to the song, but a judge now says that copyright doesn't apply to the version of the song we're all familiar with. While the legal battle continues, see how TV writers have changed the song over the years to avoid being sued by going to centerforamericatv.org.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about bad bosses. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now, on a program I also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now, during a poker tournament at the Borgata Hotel, Casino, and Spa in Atlantic City, New Jersey, hotel engineers were investigating a sewer leak and made a startling discovery. Someone had flushed millions of dollars worth of poker chips down the hotel's toilets. The tournament was suspended and the chips proved to be counterfeit. A check of the tournament chips found that about 160 counterfeit $5,000 chips had been used in tournament play. Someone was cheating and apparently got too nervous to continue and flushed the rest of the fakes. Player Christian Luzardi, age 43, of Fayetteville, North Carolina, admitted to buying the chips from China, but what crime to charge him with? Well, after a plea agreement, prosecutors recommended that Christian pay $463,540 in damages to the casino for interrupting the tournament, $9,455 for damage to the plumbing, plus face a 3-year prison sentence for criminal mischief, and since the chips bore the trademark of the hotel, a 5-year sentence for trademark counterfeiting. Ouch! So basically, he lost big going in on a very, very bad bet. Sorry, the house always wins. And he's going to the big house because of it. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? October 16th is National Bosses Day. Now, most people have been lucky enough to have pretty decent bosses, but there are stories out there of bosses from hell. And sadly, according to a recent Gallup poll, 70% of employees dislike their bosses. So what can be done to change that figure? Dr. Kevin Mays has helped thousands of leaders and hundreds of teams revolutionize their performance. He's a psychotherapist and the author of Totem, Mastering Team Performance. He joins us on the line right now from Michigan. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Peter. Great to be here.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So, as I've often said, and I've had pretty decent bosses through the years, one horrible one, but mostly decent ones. But as I've often said, boss spelt backwards is double S-O-B. So, I guess there is some truth, especially considering this Gallup poll that I mentioned, there is some truth that people have a problem with their bosses. But I don't think anybody sets out in their day to say, I'm going to be a horrible boss. So from the idea of becoming a boss to the execution of being a boss, what happens to some of these people?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is how our system works, our culture, our society, it fascinates me. There is no training for a boss. The reason somebody becomes a boss is they're really good at doing a particular job. So if I'm an accountant and I'm really good at accounting, how do I get acknowledged? I get a promotion. And as I get promoted, it's suddenly a totally different skill set that's required of me. And perhaps something I've never learned about, I've never had any training in, It's about relationship at that point. So because I'm good at mastering this task, I get promoted to a role that requires me to have good relationships with people, something I might not understand at all. Just because somebody's good at a task doesn't make them good at managing people. And the odd thing about the way our system works is that's how we promote people. If you're good at a task, we assume you're going to be good at managing people. And sometimes that's exactly the place people shouldn't be, is managing people. So, they should be doing more tasks.
So even though there is a principle that unfortunately has the same name as me, the whole term, the Peter principle, which is being being raised to your level of incompetence, is that what's at play here, you think?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of it. But again, I go back to it's a different skill set. It's just such a different skill set that there should be in place a system for people who have the ability and the ability to manage and to create relationships. Really, the job of a manager or a boss isn't to tell people what to do. But often when they're at wit's end, they don't know what else to do. That's what they resort to. A leader's job is to help others be better and help people thrive. If they had that first and foremost in their head and had skills to help other people thrive, they'd create amazing organizations. Instead, what happens? They end up getting frustrated or irritated, and they become reactive. And they start telling people what to do. In fact, I really say there's four types of bad bosses that everybody's experienced. There's the steamroller, right? When they get frustrated, they just plow over people. There's the dream crusher. The steamroller and the dream crusher. The dream crusher is the one who always has a reason why things can't be done, and they always find the flaw in everything that you do. They're the micromanagers, right? I always think of them, the ones I've had, the dream crushers, like a shovel full of dirt thrown on a fire. They just put out my inspiration. Then there's the dust storm. The dust storm is the individual who has all these great ungrounded ideas, and they give you no guidance and leadership, just leave you on your own, kind of hanging out there to figure things out for yourself. And finally, the one I think of is the jellyfish. The jellyfish is this kind of, they're soft, they don't make hard decisions, they seem to blame other people, but they have this passive aggressive, like these tentacles, right? You brush them against them, they're soft on the surface, but they have this passive aggressive quality that stings you on the backside, really. So one of those four types, I think we've all experienced.
Okay.
And the thing is, again, I go back to is the individual's inability to create relationships when they're under the gun.
Okay, so these four types that you just described, let's look at it in terms of relationships. You know, people often say that it's someone who grows up in an abusive family dynamic can sometimes often grow up to be an abuser themselves. Those four types you just described, is it possible that a person who becomes a boss like that experienced a boss like that?
You know, I would take it even further back, Peter. It's our family system, right? You think about this fact. 32 out of the first 33 astronauts to fly into space were oldest children in their families. So it's even older than bosses, right? It's the way we come into the world and the way we learn to be. I have a couple little kids myself, a couple small children. The oldest acts like an oldest child. He's telling his youngest child what to do. So he has that natural capacity. Guess what he's going to do in 30 years when he's a leader? He'll be good at telling people what to do. Telling people what to do is sometimes exactly the right thing to do as a leader, and sometimes it's exactly the wrong thing. It's really about learning how to be intentional and strategic and not letting those patterns that we've developed over our life, those patterns of thinking and our personality, not letting those patterns dictate what we do, but instead being intentional and being choiceful.
Okay, so where do you come in? You wrote the book Totem, Mastering Team Performances. How do you teach someone to use the right pattern, take the right path, and be the right type of boss?
Well, the first step, it starts with there's really three key elements to this first step. You have to have, an individual has to have presence. I have to have the ability to be self-possessed, to be in the moment, to not get caught up in the process of thinking about the future, what's going to happen, or what just happened, which most of us spend our lives in one of those places, and we miss the present moment. So the first step, having the ability to be in the present moment, then from that platform of presence, to be able to cultivate and develop awareness, self-awareness, awareness of yourself and what those patterns are, awareness of the other and the situation. And then third, to be able to act from that place intentionally, to be able to decide what needs to happen in the situation and do so out of a place that's not based on patterns of thinking that are ingrained from childhood, that aren't just emotionally reactive patterns, but are really intentional decisions that are designed to help the other person be better. Now, that's the first thing. The second is to recognize that when people come together, and this is what I really talk about in my book, that when people come together and form a team, their influence is their behavior, rather, is influenced by the behavior of others in the group. In that way, the team has an identity in and of itself. You could say it has its own personality. Every team has its own personality. Most leaders, though, don't understand that and don't know how to lead a team. They simply try to work with individuals and do their own maybe inept job leading individuals and never really understand the team dynamic and the human dynamic that happens when people come together. So from a place of presence and awareness that individuals, leaders, I teach them to be able to, A, make intentional decisions on how you influence individuals, but also to understand the cultural dynamic that's forming in your team and be intentional in creating that culture.
Well, one of the things you mentioned was self-awareness. And, you know, again, it's a pretty high number according to the Gallup poll. It seems pretty high to me, 70%. People dislike their bosses. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that they're bad bosses. It could be bad employees. But when it comes to bosses or so-called bad bosses, are they self-aware? I mean, does a bad boss know he or she's a bad boss?
My experience is some do, but the vast majority of bosses that people would say are bad bosses are people who believe they are right and justified in doing what they do. And in many ways, it goes back to us just playing out our daddy issues and our authority issues, right? When my manager or my boss is not giving me the attention I need, not acknowledging the great job I'm doing, it evokes some deeper primal reaction in me. And I start to vilify them, make them into this negative thing. And that way, it makes me okay to make them wrong. It gives me greater enhanced self-worth and makes me feel better about myself to say they're wrong, especially if I get negative feedback, right? We all have been subject to the annual EDP. As antiquated as we know that system is, we all get it. What's everybody focus on? Not all the things we got right, but the one thing that they said we could improve on. That's what we do. That's human nature, to focus on, oh, they said all this stuff we did right, one thing we did wrong, we hear the one thing we did wrong, and it hurts us. We take it as a shot to our own value.
Okay. We have just about a minute. I know this is a loaded question, but does the dynamic change if the boss is a male or a female?
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. Again, though, because it's about how the story we're making up in our own head. And here's the thing. You can't change the boss's behavior, male or female, but you can change the story you create about it. You see, if you're my boss and I believe you're out to get me and you're a bad boss, I'm going to start thinking about you differently. I'm going to start behaving with you differently. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is where I challenge people to get out of their own way, get out of their own head, and to start to stop telling that story, to tell a different story, to be able to take ownership 100% for their own behavior and their own thinking and not blame the boss and not let the boss rent space in their head, but to fully own their existence here. We get one shot at it, I said. We get a 100-year gift, one shot, and it's hacked to go around blaming other people or falling victim in our own minds, because somebody else has the power and we don't. We don't have to live that way. It's about individual employees taking ownership. It's not about blaming the boss. There are bad bosses, yes, but it's all about us owning our life.
Fascinating stuff indeed. The book is Totem, Mastering Team Performance, written by Dr. Kevin Mays. People can go to your website, which is drkevinmays.com, correct?
That's correct.
I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, it is my pleasure. My pleasure. Be intentional and be happy.
Dr. Kevin Mays, author of Totem, Mastering Team Performance. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0320, and you'll find links to Kevin's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A woman arrived at her Manatee, Florida home to discover a man inside carrying a backpack. She not only confronted him, but grabbed him and held on, dumping the backpack out, assuming it was filled with her belongings. Sure enough, her jewelry and credit cards were among the items spilled. She wouldn't let the man go until he agreed to let her take several photos of his face with her cell phone camera and remove the socks covering his hands so that he would have to open the door with his bare hands, leaving fingerprints. He complied and fled. When sheriff's deputies arrived, they looked at the photos and identified the suspect as 26-year-old Stephen Haynes, thanks in part to the distinct tattoo on his chest that she included in the photo. Deputies discovered Haynes was due to appear for a drug test the next day, which was required by an earlier probation. Haynes not only showed up, but when searched, he was found to have drug paraphernalia and 6 doses of alleged heroin. He was charged with burglary, drug offenses, and probation violations. Okay, first of all, kudos to that very brave and smart woman who got pictures of Steve, but seriously, why would someone go in for a court-appointed drug test carrying drug paraphernalia and heroin, especially the day after attempting a home robbery the night before? I mean, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0320. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0320. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air online or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.